drive you crazy. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. Baby, I want to love you like a lover should. You're fine, so kind. Tell the world that you're mine.
Great Balls of Fire, Jerry Lee Lewis, born on this day in 1935. As we do our music interludes of this day in history, we are now going to take a look at the Islamic State, American policy, what is happening around the world and why, with our guests all joining us here. Benjamin Friedman is research fellow in Defense and Homeland Security Studies for Cato Institute. Dr. Adel Shamu is Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, Senior Analyst in Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. Dr. Tabet Abdullah, Associate Professor of Middle East History, Associate Dean for External Relations at York University of Toronto, specializes in medieval, early modern Iraq. Pardon my throat today, folks. Recent books are Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos, Iraq Since 1989, and A Short History of Iraq. Welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks.
So, folks, join us here, 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at Steiner Show, talk at steinershow.org, log on to our Facebook pages, or tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this segment of our conversation. So, pardon me, I do apologize for my throat today, but...
That makes two of us, Mark.
Okay, top it. I'm not alone. Good. we'll cough together through the whole show. That's great. So as we look at what's going on in the president's announcement, the President of the United States announcement about what they didn't realize its strength of Islamic State. I just let me take a step backwards and let me start with you, Tabet. I've asked you this before. You've talked about this before, but I think it's important to kind of set up and then we move ahead. Which is the root of this? Where the power or seeming power of Islamic State comes from?
Two sources. One, the legacy of Ba'athist and Saddamist rule in Iraq, and second, the destruction of the state of Iraq by the United States. These two factors are the ones that produced a series of extremist movements in the region, a legacy of authoritarianism and a culture of violence. And then, of course, the fertile soil, which is the destruction of the state. I mean, there's lawlessness. All these things come to a head. We know that so many of the commanders of ISIS, many of the of those that are in the field, were members of Saddam Hussein's armed forces. But it's not just the technical knowledge. It's the whole culture of violence and fear and the acceptance that this is a proper way to solve social conditions that were bred by four decades of Ba'athist fascism. And then when the United States came in and destroyed the state and got rid of the army, got rid of the police, this provided a vacuum through which these extremist movements evolved in. I think that for a couple of years, after a period that was really difficult in 2007, 2008, things were beginning to stabilize. But then the civil war in Syria created another opportunity with the complete lawlessness in parts of the country that enabled these movements to emerge.
And Adel, and then we'll bring Ben in. I mean, we're seeing this kind of destruction of many parts of the Arab and Muslim world. I mean, we're watching what's happening in Libya. You're seeing what's happening right now in Iraq and Syria. And it is the rise of groups like Boko Haram in Nigeria and other groups.
And watch Yemen. Yemen is going to be the next.
Yeah, and Yemen is clearly falling apart. So, I mean, we're seeing this complete kind of withering away of any kind of structure in society. I think that that's why it calls into question in some ways what our policy is. But talk a bit about that, Adel.
Well, I agree with Thabit, but that's really sort of the historical tale of what's happening. There are more recent events, and the recent events of the Arab Spring, there was a great hope among the Arabs in general. But in reality, the colonial powers, they mustered their forces and their influence. They hijacked the Syrian revolution, and they derailed the Iraqi government and were not able to do anything other than serve our interest and the Iranian interest. And we were not able to influence the corrupt government in Middle East because they are the one who helped fund and hijack the Syrian revolution. They are the one who that funding, and we warned them that the funding of the opposition and these terrorist organizations, some of them in Syria, that they will infiltrate to Iraq. That will be the scene of the battle. So the Saudis, have you ever heard criticism of the Saudis, by the way, in our media? Very, very, very little. Beheading, Saudis are master of beheading and cutting arms of thief and other barbaric methods, and nobody talks about them. And the Qataris and the Bahrainis and Kuwaitis, these are all corrupt regimes. They oppress their people, they squander the treasury, and of course we had the icing on the cake when Maliki veered to the sectarianism and never got out of it. That is the more recent really event which contributed to ISIL rise, and to my shock that our intelligence services never knew about it. Everybody wrote about it. Who knows anything about Middle East? That some groups like that will rise, and because the elements of the fertile grounds, if you seed something and there is no fertile grounds, right, the plant doesn't come up. There was a great fertile grounds of oppression, of no freedom and no justice, and lack of economic development. And that's what's happening in Yemen. That's what will happen in Egypt, unfortunately. It's happening in Libya. It's a disaster for the Arabs, and is a disaster to us eventually.
And I think it does have, if the Arab and Muslim world continues to disintegrate for all the reasons you're laying out, Ben Friedman, then this kind of constant war we've talked about, this 13-year war, could be a 23-year war, a 30-year war.
Yeah, I think that from the perspective of the United States, perhaps the lesson is that we shouldn't contribute to the destabilization of these places. I think that what we've heard already, and I agree with it, is that in a sense, these we have strong regimes often because they're weak states, or weak nations. We don't have a sense of nationalism that unifies places like Iraq and Syria, and certainly not liberalism, which is a long-developed thing that causes people to resolve their conflicts peacefully. And in the absence of strong national identity and liberalism, you have polities that are really liable to fall apart into this sort of violence that we see. And the tendency in the United States, especially lately, to just think that we can revolutionize the regime or give some guns and weapons to one, guns and money to one allegedly liberal or moderate party, and then some sort of stable liberal situation will result, is a little bit crazed, I think. What we did in Libya, for example, strikes me as sort of the height of irresponsibility, and we've been congratulating ourselves for our great moral leadership there as the place disintegrates into very predictable chaos, predicted chaos, because Gaddafi didn't leave a civil society or a bureaucracy that was really capable of running the place. He just had oil money that he could use to buy people off. So we, I think, ought to relax or reverse our tendency to sort of be a revolutionary power. We're now, a counter-revolutionary power in Iraq, and we're still trying to be revolutionaries in Syria by giving money to rebels we call moderate. It's not consistent or logical, I think.
So I mean, I, you know, when I look at what's going on, so President Barack Obama and his administration have their Libya, and George Bush has Iraq, which kind of began the meltdown of as you were talking about, Tabit, of many Arab and Muslim nations, especially Arab nations, I should say. And so I guess, you know, when you watch this unfolding, and I'm looking at the news the other night about last night and on the web about what's going on the border between Syria and Turkey. and the kind of uncomfortableness that both Turkey and Saudi Arabia have about coming into this war, being drawn into it because of all the contradictions they face. And that's what just blows my mind about so much this topic is everywhere you look, there's the contradictions inside of Saudi Arabia and why they want to be involved, but how in some ways the whole Wahhabist movement fueled some of this stuff ideologically. And Turkey threatening to come in, but then they have to address Kurdish issues in Turkey, northwestern Syria, not, let alone the almost independent state of Kurdish Iraq. So it's so bloody complex and confusing. It's almost hard to understand where to take the conversation or how anybody should respond.
Well, the issue becomes very confusing and complex because of the fragmentation of society, because there are so many different forces that emerge. It doesn't become clearly polarized, say, between two ideologies or two classes, say. Rather, you know, it's completely fragmented. I agree with Ada that a very important element here is the regional conflicts, the role of Saudi Arabia and the role of Turkey. And there, the main fear, of course, is the Iranian influence. And the and this had existed since the Iranian revolution. With the collapse of Iraq, there was an opportunity now to use proxies to fight the spread of Iranian influence via a sectarian notion. And this is now really coming to a head in Yemen, where Shia forces are on the rise and Saudi Arabia is panicking. So we could really see another example of what happened in Iraq and Syria take place in Yemen. I'm not exactly sure what more to add to this, rather just to repeat, I think, an old argument that I've constantly made on this program, and that is that I don't believe that the Arab world suffers from some kind of an essentialist notion of a lack of a strong nationalist feelings. There have been periods where nationalist feelings were extremely powerful, very widespread. The notion of Iraqi nationhood, I think, did take root. There's no way that it would take root among everybody, but among an elite that actually had strong respect and a powerful hegemony over the country. There is no more of a nationally coherent people than the Egyptians, and yet we see social fragmentation there too. So it's not that the Arabs suffer from some essentialist problem of a lack of national feelings. National feelings can come and go depending on context, and the context here is a prolonged period of fascism and the American destructive wars that actually fragmented society.
So let me take a brief break and come back and comment on that. Call us here at 410-319-8888, and we'll also be exploring then what should be a Western response at this moment in history. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. We're going to break with Miles Davis, Black Satin. He passed away yesterday, not yesterday literally, but in our day in history. Stay with us. Back with Miles Davis, Same beautiful tune, Black Satin, passed away on this day, but September 28th, 1991, which would be the anniversary was yesterday. We're here with Dr. Otto Shamu, Associate Fellow, the Institute for Policy Studies, Dr. Tavala Dolla, Associate Professor of Middle East History, Ben Friedman, Research Fellow at Cato Institute. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Please join us with your thoughts on where you think America should go, why we're there. I mean, this does beg the question, but Otto, now go to Ben. I mean, so we watched the response of this administration and Republicans in the House and Senate are saying, you know, that we had to pursue this war and calling Congress back if they need to address it. But I mean, so what does it mean to address this? In some ways, as we've been talking about, we created the mess we're trying to address.
Go ahead.
In Iraq, and I agree totally that it was the United States' invasion of Iraq and essentially destruction of the government was a necessary condition for circumstances in Iraq to be as they have turned out. But I do think that the lack of nationhood is also a factor in the level of insurgency that occurs there. And that's not to say there was never a sense of Iraqi nationalism. There was certainly when they were fighting a war with Iran for so long. But I do think it's a factor. The Egypt is a different story largely, not only because, of course, the United States didn't intervene there, but I think, of course, they have a stronger sense of nationalism, and that's one reason why, for all the unrest there, you don't have a sustained insurgency. So I think my point there holds. And from the United States' perspective, addressing the situation, of course, it could mean opposing military intervention in Syria, but it also might mean, if the Congress were to get serious about overseeing the administration on this, addressing the contradictions in the policy we now have. And to me, we have basically two policies in Syria alone, one where we think we can continue to fund rebels and train rebels who are somehow going to win the civil war there and establish a political order that we think will be more favorable to us, more liberal or something. And secondly, a policy of bombing ISIS, of course, which favors the Assad regime. We are, whether we admit it or not, helping the Assad regime by going after one of or two of the biggest rebel groups that are opposing them. And if ISIS is this sort of great mounting threat, as our political system is telling us it is, then it seems to me one of the things you could do is to ally yourself with Assad, as unpalatable as it is, openly. And if we're unwilling to do that, it seems to me maybe evidence that the threat isn't as big as we say it is.
Otto, what were you about to say?
Well, Obama's policy, unfortunately, runs counter to what he has been saying for the past 6 years. He believes in justice, in democracy, in freedom of the people. We should help them. Contrary to his Cairo speech, it's amazing how, it is repulsive to see two Americans beheaded. But that should not make our policy change dramatically, where tens of thousands of people are getting killed and will get killed by this policy of to basically intervene in another nation and try to push them back. Yeah, they are threatening. Well, there are a lot of maniacs threatening the homeland, and trying to bomb them out of existence is not going to make them peaceful. Yeah, we love you. Now we're not going to try to kill you. Our involvement there, what it does, it enhances ISIL. That's really something I want to emphasize. It enhances ISIL for the same reason we just agreed on, that there were grievances and already a fertile ground in the Middle East for groups like ISIL, because people do not want foreign invaders. They don't want foreign forces. And the fact that we recently came there and we screwed it up royally, basically. So his policies now are counterproductive, and they are missing the big big hole in it, in fact, that there is no more talking about democracy. There's no more talking about justice. We are supporting 100% the corrupt regime in Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and now, unfortunately, in Egypt and in Libya. So, that's really what we're doing. How is that going to save us? How is that going to win the heart and soul? I support Obama in what I call it, instead of... is right to rescue, R2R basically, right to rescue. But to go and rescue the Yazidis in 2-3 days and get out of there, I support that.
But
not going in a permanent way, we are going to be there for about 5 years at least.
Let me bring you back in here. I mean, because as Otto's describing this, you know, there are two things going on in Baghdad at this moment. One is there's a comedy troupe making fun of Islamic State as we speak in a comedy routine. On the other side is that the report from an hour ago outside of Baghdad is that the Islamic State forces are 1 mile away from the city.
Yeah, it's an area called Amriyat al-Fallujah, but apparently they were driven back. I mean,
There were bombings taking place, American other planes pushing them back.
That's right.
But they haven't moved back. They're still fighting.
Well, okay.
Well, whatever, that we don't know. Whatever is it going? But I'm saying that's how close it is.
Yes, yes. Look, I was on your program before. It's extremely uncomfortable and very painful for me to discuss this. When the Americans went in 2003, I opposed the American invasion, though I wasn't prepared to defend Saddam Hussein's regime, even though all of my life I've waited to see the end of that horrible dictatorship, because I knew that the Americans are not going to actually invest the necessary investments to reconstruct the country as they did in Germany, for example, after World War II. But this, in my opinion, is a different matter. The barbarism of this group, the threats that it poses to whole communities. It's not easy for me to say, yes, I support the American involvement. I think it's extremely valid. In fact, this should be the role of the progressive movement in the United States, is not to simply say, don't get involved. You know, we don't want to intervene in other people's messes, but rather to be a watchdog over how to intervene, to criticize the United States for not taking the necessary measures against the sources of ISIS, such as in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, because they are allies of the United States. I think there should be some discussion about exactly the means of intervention. But just a couple of days ago, I spoke to my aunt in Baghdad, you know, an elderly woman who was absolutely petrified because, as you say, there are reports that they've come near Baghdad. I don't think they'll go in there. But the disasters that befell the Christians and the Yazidis in Mosul, the threats that people feel in other parts of the country, what am I supposed to tell them? Wait? It will work itself out in 10 years, you know, hide in the cellars in the meantime. The United States has the ability to check this extremely barbaric, very dangerous group. And despite my 1,001 reservations about American intentions, I support their role in attacking this group.
Well, can I answer that, Mark?
Yeah, I do want to get Ben back in the conversation.
Ben. Go ahead. Let Ben go ahead.
Ben and Otto, go ahead, and then we'll get back to the phones.
I would just say that it seems to me that in both Iraq and in Syria, and particularly in Syria, the circumstances are that for the United States of America and other outside interveners, we have to make a choice between supporting a liberal government and supporting rebellion of some kind that is going to lead to continued chaos. It seems to me that those are the real basic alternatives on the ground, particularly in Syria. The idea that there's some third alternative where we support rebels in some nice way and win the hearts and minds of the moderate or liberal people strikes me as something that's basically impossible in a political sense to achieve. In Syria, you have a situation where either Assad or someone like him will run the country in a way that's heavy-handed and grossly upsetting the people of liberal sentiment, or you'll have continued civil war or at least political violence as far as the eye could see. And the United States continues to avoid and evade those alternatives and pretend that there's some nice liberal alternative. And we spent a long time in Iraq trying to build a nice liberal, stable alternative to continued anarchy or a sectarian, upsetting regime. And I think we still haven't learned the lesson of all that. We still haven't learned the lesson that there's not a good outcome that's going to please us at low cost. That's just a dream and a fantasy.
I don't know what you're about to say, that I'm opening the phones here.
Well, look, Thabit mentioned his relative. I'm a Chaldean. There are thousands and thousands of Chaldeans are being killed. Over 150,000 refugees from all these northern cities. And I was just visiting a lot of people from that area in El Cajon, west of San Diego. It's a horrible, horrible situation. But the problem is, it's our allies who created this problem with their billions of dollars and weapons. And to forget that, the same thing with Syria, to forget that the Syrian rebels, many, many of these groups were ready to cause a massacre of Christians and minorities in Syria. So supporting them, that's one reason Assad remained in power, because the minorities supported him, because their life depends on him. These minorities have already slaughtered some minorities, and that's why the rebellious was hijacked by the Kuwaitis and Bahrainis and Qataris and Saudis. If we don't understand that, and we go now support all these groups we are supporting with arms and money, slaughter will happen. The Americans did not go, by the way, and save the Chaldeans. They did not. None of them. We went and saved the Yazidis. That's it. That's a 2-3 day operation.
But
so our intent, Thabit, you're missing the point. Our intent is not clean. Is not clean. Why, for example, they didn't go and save hundreds of thousands of refugees from Bartola, Al Quds, Zaho, and all these areas? They didn't. They did not. As a matter of fact, the Peshmerga, which are our strongest allies, they withdrew from these areas. They withdrew from Mosul. They fought nothing of ISIL. They wanted to have nothing to do with them.
So let me open the phone, because I think the question still remains. I mean, what you do, and what I'm assuming what Taba was saying. So does the West stand by and do nothing and just allow the Islamic State to take over places that we've destroyed? I mean, that's why they're there. So I think that's one of the questions people are asking. But let's see what folks think at 410-319-8888. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Susan.
My feeling is that our going in there and being violent is like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. And I agree with the person on the panel who suggested that we created a lot of what's going on there through our wars. I think Obama is very intelligent, and yet I don't understand why he did this, and he did this without approval of Congress and unilaterally. Like, several countries have joined in since, but I'd like to get an idea from the panelists what they think his true motives are.
Whose motives?
Obama's motives. Is it oil? Is it to please the public? I just don't get it.
I mean.
Can I say something here?
Please, Tom, go ahead.
I don't have any doubt about the mess that the United States creates when they get involved in regions that they don't understand very well. They're not prepared to put in the necessary investments, both in terms of money and lives, actually, to stabilize a situation. I have no doubt about that. But I'm really a bit amazed at the, well, you know, the so-called progressive American movement. I mean, when the Rwanda massacres happened, everybody was up in arms saying, how could we sit back and do nothing? Well, if the United States had gotten involved in that, I'm sure there would have been numerous problems that they would have left behind. And yet there is a moral imperative. There is even more so of a moral imperative to be involved, including in the use of force to an extent in Iraq, because the United States is so responsible for much of what has happened there. The ISIS group is not basically another political factor that one can support or one can be against. It represents the most barbaric side of human nature.
I'm with you, Sabit.
I agree with Ada that the United States didn't get involved in a proper way. They missed this point. They didn't do that point. This is what we should actually criticize. But in terms of the United States getting involved, including militarily, and I say specifically in Iraq. Now, in Syria, there's a bit of a different issue. I agree with the panelists who were saying that you know, supporting one rebel group over another is, in a way, asking for trouble. But in Iraq, there is an elected government, as corrupt as it is, with all of its numerous deficiencies. It does represent a general will. Just today, I'm reading in the Iraqi press that an agreement has been reached with the Kurdish government, and a Kurdish delegation is now has arrived in Baghdad to take part in the parliament. I think it's absolutely legitimate and, in fact, morally important for the United States to be involved in Iraq to try and defeat this evil group.
So let me get one more thought. I'll come right back to you, Adil and Ben. Let me get another caller in here, 410-319-8888. Will, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you feeling?
Very well, welcome.
Just simply, as a 36-year-old man, I am not absent of memory when it comes to the 2003 invasion of Iraq and, you know, prior to that, Afghanistan, and all based upon interpretations that, you know, these countries had weapons of mass destruction or either was responsible for the 2001 terrorist attack. Because if you look back, of course, prior to 2001, there was an anti-Islamic, or rather an anti-fundamental Islamic sentiment in America, but yet 2001 started this, what we're talking about. But if we look even prior to 2001, you know, America, and I'm using the word we here lightly, but we funded, you know, a lot of the terrorist groups that we complained about in 2001 that attacked us. We funded the terrorists who, you know, ousted Muammar Gaddafi that we now complain about. We funded,
right,
you know, ISIS, in which we can, you know, reports indicate that they have been supported with American weapons, you know, due to their allegiances. My question is, we talk heavily about other countries being evil and being wicked and being the worst of mankind. But when we talk about our government, we always use subtleties of explanations as to why they are and why, yes, they are destroying the world. Now, lastly, I'll just point this out. When we talk about these issues, we must talk about Israel, because Israel, one of the worst, you know, abusers of rights in the Middle East, is always supported unanimously. The Congress and Senate votes to support Israel because no one wants to go against its lobbies, or rather their political, you know, agenda.
Right.
My point is, America is wicked. We need to realize that, and all of us on the media, all of the people you born, will have to deal with the reality of the people when the people realize that they have been mistreated and misguided. You're stating these individuals' names. In the future, future tense, I personally believe that any individual who have the responsibility of misleading the people should deal with the people justly as they should be dealt with.
Well, thank you so much. Adil, let me let you go ahead first.
I agree with him. I had a big one. The sanctions in the 90s, this is well documented now, and those taxes were led by the United States. And I want Thabit to hear this. 500,000 Iraqi children died of lack of medicine and malnutrition.
I wrote about this. I've
absolutely.
About it.
So half a million. So well. No matter how much everybody else has done, including ISIL, they have never killed 500,000. I'm not trying to compare the two. Believe me, they're barbaric. We have a democracy and a civilization, and we could change policy. And that's what we hoped with Obama. Obama, I think what they have done to him, this briefing every morning he gets scared the heck out of any president, and I think they have scared him into acting really contrary to what he believes in. And it is scary to see him the way he talks now. He sounds like George Bush.
Well, we have like 5 minutes left. Let me bring Ben back in, come back to Thabit before we run out of time completely. Ben?
Well, I would just say that it's difficult, I think, to have a useful policy conversation when you start off by saying it's up to us to start genocide, and it's like Rwanda, because what that asks of us is to get into the civil war management business, and it's terrible and morally upsetting to watch any group of people be killed and watch a gruesome group like ISIS or the Islamic State take power and do awful things, but there's no neutral refereeing role available to us. If we get involved in fighting a war against them, we assume responsibility for the political outcomes that result, and there's not going to be a clean one. There's not going to be one where a nice liberal order results. And so, yeah, if you want to help the Iraqi state, as we're doing, it's a sensible policy and will probably lead to a better outcome, but you're a counter-revolutionary power that's helping out a sectarian Shiite regime run the place, and maybe they'll do it a little more nicely than Maliki's government did, but it seems unlikely that it's going to be palatable. And if you think that Syria is the circumstances in Syria and the slaughter of people there is a moral imperative that requires U.S. intervention, it seems to me you ought to be prepared to say what's required is somebody to run the state and the end of civil war and the end of killing. And that result is probably, again, not going to be a nice liberal order, but rather one that is morally offensive to us in some other way.
Thabit, to close this out.
The United States does not have, with all of its incredible abilities, does not have the power to actually completely shape regimes any way it wants. The Iraqi government right now does not want American boots on the ground. They've passed, in fact, a resolution very recently, putting an end to that question. They want basically air support. And I believe that the American involvement has brought, I agree with what Ben just said, that this is a sectarian government in Iraq, but it's not a barbaric one. It is one that is open to working with other groups. And I think the steps that the Abadi government has just done are encouraging, actually, agreements with the Kurds, establishing Sunni battalions in the army that are actually leading the fight against ISIS. These are encouraging signs. This is the kind of thing that the progressive movement in the United States should be pushing its government to do. And I think there is a profound moral imperative on the part of the United States not to cut and run, but to be engaged, to be involved, because they are partly responsible and because there is a moral obligation to do so.
We are literally out of time. I think we have maybe 30, right? Am I right? Are we up against it right now? So this has been a great conversation. It's been a lot of different positions for people to wrestle with and think about. I want to thank our guest, as usual, Dr. Thabit Abdallah, joining us from York University in Toronto, where he's Associate Professor of Middle East History. Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and Senior Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, and Ben Friedman, Research Fellow in Defense and Homeland Security for Cato Studies. Thank the three of you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And I think I hope this opens some ideas and thoughts. It's a very complex subject, and we had a range of opinion for us to wrestle with here. Reminding you on our way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Sienna Greaves. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes on your favorite podcast app. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. You don't stop, rock the rhythm that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought two friends.